In the interest of her own expansive curiosity, the writer Mary Roach has wanted to know what happens to the body after death. So she spent some time with cadavers to find out. She's wanted to know if there's any hard evidence of an afterlife, so she set in on sessions with mediums and ghost hunters. Wanted to know how sex actually works, mechanically, what space actually does to the human body, what happens to animals who break the law. And when you're this willing, this omnivorous and intrepid, and just game to go investigate, you're open to all kinds of ideas. And it just so happened a few years ago, Mary Roach got an idea from a woman named Judy. Judy sent an email with this idea. How about a book about football referees? And Mary said she couldn't have been less interested.
I don't know why she connected me with that. I don't watch football. I don't understand football. I don't have a clue what these professionals do. But anyway, we started communicating through email. And it turned out that she's an amputee. And I said, that's an interesting area. Tell me about your experience. And she said, well, I'm an elective amputee. I'm somebody who requested an amputation. She'd had spina bifida. And the way her lower leg foot grew in, it was twisted. She couldn't run. She couldn't walk well. She would see people with lower leg prostheses and see that they were running, jumping, hiking, doing things she really couldn't do well. And it was very hard for her to find a surgeon willing to cut off her foot. It was interesting in hearing her talk about the resistance that she got from surgeons and from people she would talk to, this sense of the importance of wholeness. You know, that the body is this whole entity and that you shouldn't mess with it unless you really, really have to. That it's better to have all your parts than to be missing something, which is a bias of the able-bodied, the people who have everything. I mean, if you have two functioning feet, you can't imagine wanting one to be cut off. That led me to think about, are there human-made bits and pieces that are as good as what we start out with? Are they always a compromise? Kind of where are we at? There's a lot of hype out there in the world of prosthetics and body replacements, and I was just kind of curious, are we like printing these things up in the labs now? Are we growing them from scratch? Where are we at? It was all new to me, and that's kind of how things got rolling.
When you were first thinking about this, what did you think about the human body early on, like limitations or the gifts of the human body? You know, what were you thinking?
I think, like anyone, I have a sense of the human body as a pretty cool machine. But also, you know, when things work, you don't give a lot of thought to all the stuff that's running in the background, all the things that your body is doing, producing, integrating to make you able to go through your day seamlessly. And when you start to look into that, which one has to when one sort of starts to look at, you know, replacement parts and kind of compare them to what we have, I was pretty gobsmacked by how incredibly complex just even the simplest part of the body really is. So I quickly became aware of what a monumental challenge it is to create a system or a part that's going to really do as well as what we all start out with. And that makes sense when you think about it. I mean, medicine and engineering have had, what, a couple of hundred years to get up to speed versus the human body, millions of years of evolutionary tinkering. So why would we be able to outperform what we're born with, you know?
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mary Roach's new book is called Replaceable You, and it's a kind of reality check right in the middle of what feels like a revolution in medicine and technology. It's a reminder of just how remarkable the human body actually is. We began our conversation with one of the earliest devices in the story, something called the masticator.
The masticator. Yeah, this is a device. It's a handheld, kind of looks like, part of it looks like garden pruners. Like, it basically cuts and mashes your food. It chews outside the mouth. And that was in the Victorian era. That was something that was handy because people's dentistry wasn't where it needed to be. Let's say that. Yeah. And dentures were not at all helpful. They were essentially cosmetic. It was like a wig for the mouth. So there would be dinner parties where someone would show up at the table and they'd converse and they'd have their horrible, ill-fitting, useless dentures in their mouth, but they would have already eaten in the privacy of their room. In other words, they masticated off in a separate room.
Yeah.
And then came, after having consumed their food, sat down at the dinner table and just appeared not to be very hungry. But it was, you know, I used that as the entrance to the book, because that's kind of how replacements have evolved. They started outside the body, like a wig, and then there were hair transplants, and now there have been efforts to actually use induced pluripotent stem cells to grow follicles. So we start outside the body, and the masticator was a fun example of that.
It's kind of like this sense of progression in these stories, I guess you're getting at there. Like, masticators give way to dentures, and glasses give way to contact lenses, and then toupees give way to hair transplants. What do you think about the idea of progress? Because it seems like the point you're making is that, as you put it, progress doesn't march in a linear line forward. It just kind of lurches forward.
That's right. And in the case of masticators and dentures, there was a long span of time where people were getting, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, dentures that were full plates of teeth that would be glued in place for the most part. I mean, that was the progress over the ones that were spring-loaded, which were god-awful. But then dentures came along. It's like, oh my God, you could just glue them in place, and it was fabulous. You'd see these ads for Polygrip. And people were, I think people are attracted to this notion of progress, and they put great faith in progress and technology. And there were people, lots of people, who were having, you know, say they had a few teeth that were bad. Instead of just pulling those and then kind of limping along, you'd have all your teeth pulled and be outfitted with dentures at a young age, too. Not an ideal option. Now we have implants. You know, you can have these pegs that are implanted into the bone, and then you kind of click the plates into those, so they're much more secure. But it's surprising how long these things take. I mean, the first hip replacement, 1938, and went through some really turbulent times. Fast forward however many years, now complication rates are down below 1%, and it's an amazing procedure, but took some time.
I want to back up to the earliest days of trying to replace body parts. And it gets us to the story of this 16th century astronomer you write about, who, as you say here in the first sentence of the chapter, his nose came off in 1566. What happened?
Tycho. I used to call him Tycho. Apparently it's Tycho Brahe. Hmm. He seemed to be a little bit arrogant, got into a fight with somebody at a dinner party, another student, sort of a macho argument, I guess, and these things tended to be, at the time, resolved with swords. And Tycho lost part of his nose in that duel. And he went around with a metal, almost not the entire nose, but large portion of it, and a box of adhesive, nose adhesive, that he would carry around. And I have a whole chapter on nose replacement noses, because it's one of the earliest body part replacements that exists. And that is because nasal mutilation, cutting off someone's nose as a punishment, was done over and over again, because not just was it a cruel thing to do, but it was kind of a crime deterrent, because everybody in the population can now see your face and see that your nose is gone and think, oh, that fate awaits me should I break the law. And because that existed, and because through over the millennia, and enough people were in this predicament, there were some very creative replacement noses.
Talk about you trace it back to these surgeons who would take, help me get this right, a flap of skin from the forehead or the cheek.
Yes.
You leave it attached on one side. You fold it over onto the, how does this work?
Yeah, it's called a pedicle flap. So say that your part of your nose is gone. Now, if you were to loosen a flap either on the cheek, you know, next to the nose, or the forehead up above, kind of twist it around, flop it down, leave it attached on one side so that it still has a blood supply, and you let it grow in and kind of shape it onto the nose. And this goes back to, you know, 1500 BC. This is one of the earliest, certainly the earliest cosmetic procedure that was done. And the problem with it was you had now scarring where you took the flap, right? And yeah. You know, where you loosened it and moved it over. So there's this surgeon, Gaspari Tagliacozzi. So he had this idea, and it was a brilliant idea, that you could take a flap from the underside of the upper arm and keep it attached and do the same thing. But of course, that means you need to hold your arm up over your head, kind of like you're sniffing your armpit to see if you smell. Yeah. So there was a whole harness to hold it there, and this would have to stay for weeks. So he had this whole, you know, the flap coming off the upper arm onto the nose, and eventually you can cut it loose, and then, you know, you're all set. But a little bit unwieldy, but brilliant. And the reason I love Gaspari Tagliacozzi is he took such great pride in his nose procedures that he, if you go, I think it's Bologna where he taught, there's a statue of him, like a full body statue. He's like kind of in a niche carved into the wall. And it's kind of like he's stepping out towards the viewer. And if you look, not closely, but you might not notice at first glance, but he's holding something in one hand. He's holding it out and showing you. And it's a nose. He's holding.
Wow.
He's holding a nose. You could just imagine the painter like, Gaspari, this is too much.
One of the stories you tell in the book is it takes you to China, Chengdu, place that has amazingly 16,000 some odd pig farms. Let's talk about this. First, what interested you about going to China? Was it just about the research itself, or were you also interested in just sort of like, you know, the regulatory environment of China as it compares to the, you know, the other part of the world, or the pace of it? Like,
I'll tell you.
What interested you about that?
A couple of things. Oh, first of all, there are two companies here in the United States that have pathogen-free pigsties. In other words, they are growing pigs, genetically engineered pigs, for, it's called xenotransplantation, where you take a pig organ and transplant it into a human. It's been genetically edited so that it won't create a what's called a hyperacute rejection. So we have them here, and it would make sense that I would have gone to one of their facilities, but they both said no. So
wow, that's a good answer.
Yeah, they said no. So we took a meeting. You know, the guy at United Therapeutics was great. He's like, oh, we love your work. We'd love for you to come here. But then he got back to me. You know what? We're not at that point right now where we're talking about it. And then eGenesis, they were lovely to speak to, and I think I spoke to somebody pretty high up. And then they just ghosted me. They totally ghosted me. So I looked around online to see what some other options were and found out that there are folks in China who've been working on xenotransplantation for 30 years. And I found a paper on where things are at with xenotransplantation in China. And I wrote to those folks. First of all, they said yes. So yeah, that was that. Yeah. That was a key element of it. But also, one of the things I mentioned in this review paper was that in China, there's not a tradition of donating your organs. There's a sense that your organs were a gift from your ancestors, and that for you to open up the body and take it out was like disrespectful. It was not, it's just not done. There's not that tradition. So there's a huge need for organs in China. You know, there are some, but they come from political prisoners or sometimes people on death row in prison. So there, you know, it would be great to have a different source. And they're certainly very good at large pig farms. So they're used to dealing with large numbers of pigs. Anyway, that made it interesting to me as well.
What's actually happening in that lab? Like, what do we learn about the process of, you know, pigs and human bodies? What are they discovering through all of this?
There's two things that are kind of slowing down the progress toward having organs, pig organs, available for everybody. One of them is viruses. Pigs and humans can share viruses. One thing that I should say about these xenotransplanted organs, you know, to date, I think there's not, maybe someone has made it to a year. They're not lasting a long time, but the idea, the hope is that you could buy enough time that somebody could make their way up the list and then receive a human organ. So, you know, it's kind of a bridge to keep someone alive while they're on the waiting list for a human organ transplantation.
You write about this man named Dr. Robert Bartlett. It runs the lab, or was running the lab anyway. You went to watch his team actually do this, remove a, I guess it's a pig's heart, right? It's
They were doing research using a pig.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're trying to, they were adjusting how much blood would flow through the heart, because sometimes the valves get kind of blown out and that kind of shortens the amount of time it stays viable. They were trying to see how could we use less fluid or adjust the flow somehow to extend the shelf life. So I was there when they were taking out a heart and then taking it across the hall to a separate room and hooking it up to this elaborate gizmo that was pumping the blood through the heart.
What was it like?
What was incredible to me, first of all, I had no idea. You take a heart out of a body and it keeps beating for like up to 10 minutes. It keeps on going. Heart, like the cardiomyocytes, the muscles, the cells of the heart, they just, that's what was like, what we do, we beat. And we just keep on beating. Like, I don't know, things feel different, but we're still going to beat. And it was so interesting because the one of the surgeons there, he said, you know, because I was marveling at that as, you know, an outsider does, like, whoa, it's still beating. This is unbelievable. Oh, it's beating. Yeah. This heart is still beating. And he said, yeah. And sometimes you have to, you know, take a slice to send to pathology and it's still beating and it's very annoying for me.
Well, Bartlett doesn't actually we don't know the full answer of why organs eventually do fail once you disconnect them from a body. And I wanted to ask you about this kind of working theory that you mentioned, which to me sounds just so, I don't know, incredible. Like that it might not just be about oxygen or nutrients, but that the brain itself is secreting, this is his idea, is secreting something that organs need that no one has really identified. Is that what's going on?
Yes. Yeah. And this was, again, not something I knew about before I went there. Dr. Bartlett, who has since passed away, Dr. Bartlett has this theory. It's a theoretical hormone. In other words, nobody has discovered it, but he feels like it has to exist. And he's even given it a name. He calls it Vitalin. So, and I said, well, how do you, where, why, how are you believing this? What's the evidence for this? And he said, okay, there are scenarios, not common and kind of grim, where, okay, if you have a pregnant person who is brain dead, okay, but there's a fetus and the fetus, like the person, the fetus, the brain of the fetus is keeping the organs of this brain dead person viable. Now, when you deliver that fetus by cesarean, right after that, the organs of this, the pregnant person, their organs quickly start to deteriorate. Normally, you'd have, 12 hours where, when someone dies, the organs, you can put them on a ventilator. You can keep them oxygenated, keep the organs viable for transplant. But it doesn't last forever. But if you, but if there were a body in there with a brain, then you can extend the amount of time that those organs would be viable. So it's like essentially a heart needs a brain. That's his theory.
Mary Roach, we're talking about her book, Replaceable You, Adventures in Human Anatomy. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Mary Roach is with us today. In her latest book, she's trying to figure out if science can build a body part that's as good as the one you're born with. We've been trying this for centuries, by the way. She talked with surgeons and engineers and, of course, the patients who live with these parts every day. And Roach says you can replace some of the originals, but the pieces science builds won't ever quite equal the ones we start out with. Her book is called Replaceable You. And then there's this part of the book where you sort of get at this question of whether you can borrow one organ to do part of another organ's job. Like, can the intestine step in and help the lungs out? And you write about this team of researchers who are working on a type of non-lung breathing. It's called enteral ventilation via anus. That is, I guess, using the rectum as a third lung?
Yeah, you got it. Yep. The mucous membranes will absorb a certain amount of oxygen from there's this material, perfluorocarbon, which you can dissolve oxygen into it, and then essentially it's like a perfluorocarbon enema, and the body is going to absorb oxygen that way. And it's not like anybody's going to switch to that, and I breathe through my ass now. No, it's something that could be used, say, in an emergency situation if there's no ventilator around and somebody's respiratory system is not working. You could sort of supplement by getting oxygen in that way. It could also be used for extremely premature infants because one of the things that's really dangerous with an extreme premature birth is the lungs aren't ready to work. They're not up to speed. And so if you could supplement by using this technology, I mean, that would be amazing. So yeah, the rectum is happy to serve as a third lung.
What do you think about that? The ability of the body to improvise or whatever,
it's kind of astounding that the body is just this amazing agreeability.
Yeah.
That the body's just like, it's not normally what I do, but I'm happy to give it a go, And I had another chapter that had to do with using the intestine to build a vagina. Yeah. And that's been something from the 1800s that's been done women who'd had cancer, and it works pretty well. Anyway, I'm endlessly impressed with the human body's tolerance for taking on these functions that it wasn't designed for and didn't evolve for. I remember seeing in one of my past books a surgery where a man, it was for a military science book, there was an IED had caused damage to the genitals, and this man had to have his urethra rebuilt. And they said, yeah, we take a little strip from inside the cheek. I'm like, well, why? He said, well, the inside of the mouth is designed to be wet all the time and it doesn't mind. So we take that, we roll it up and we use it as a urethra and it works really well.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've talked about, I wanted you to tell the story about this, becomes this chapter that you say where the book kind of really clicked in place for you. And this was in Tbilisi in Georgia. You're trying to track down this elusive surgeon. And basically he had reconstructed a man's penis using this patient's own middle finger. Would you take us through this part?
Well, sure. Yeah, this was one of the first conversations I had when I was thinking about writing this book, but I wasn't sure. I had actually called... her name is Evangelia Bellis, and she runs something called the Fat Lab. And I thought, well, fat is kind of interesting. Maybe, you know, fat, maybe let's see what's going on with fat. Turns out she works with stem cells derived from fat. And we were just talking, and somehow in that conversation, I don't remember quite how, I guess I was just saying, what else could I put in a book? What else? What else? Mm. And she told me this story of this paper she'd come across. Wherein a surgeon had done just what you said, had taken a man's middle finger and used it to reconstruct his penis. He'd had cancer. And of course, because I know nothing, and I was initially just picturing the finger taken, you know, as is and sort of stitched in place and being a functioning finger there. And I'm like, whoa, yeah. Got to include that. Well, yeah, like able to kind of bend and go like, hey, come here.
Yeah.
But not the case. It was the, you know, the finger was serving the function that, you know, I don't know why this surgeon didn't just use one of those inserts that is used. It's a surgical implant. You can, there are the kind that you pump up. There are some that are just sort of flexible that are inserts. But for whatever reason, he used the man's middle finger. And I've seen photographs because I went all the way to Tbilisi because that's the kind of person I am. it's impressive. It looks like a penis. And it does actually kind of bend in a weird sort of midway along way, which is bizarre. But it was to extend it so he could pee standing up, which was important to him, and he could have intercourse. So it was an interesting, again, you know, the notion of taking one body part and recruiting it to do something entirely different.
Well, and the chapter's an adventure too. You're trying to sort of track this guy down, showing up. He's on vacation. Like it's a whole thing, and then the moment when the staff is sort of demonstrating it and just show how like this thing really works, and here's a ceramic pitcher that will hang from it.
The guy was on vacation, and yeah. You know, I tried to call and email, and you know, I used Google Translate. I translated into Russian and Georgian, and nobody replied. So I'm like, let me just go there. And he was gone, and I was like, oh my God, I've come all the way from America, you know, to which the proper response would be, well, you're an idiot. But the woman there, I think, took pity on me, and she said, well, come into his office, and we'll look. There are photographs, there are slides on his computer. Mm-hmm. And she's showing me, you know, not showing the man's face, of course, showing me the stages of the procedure and the after shots, and one of them was to show, I guess, how robust this penis was or how strong it was, because it was there was a ceramic water pitcher, you know, lovely, white with a kind of floral pattern, hung from the penis.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, the kind of thing. This is why you go all the way to Tbilisi.
Yes. You mentioned this a little bit before, this section in the book where you go to Cedars-Sinai to the transgender surgery and health program there. And it raises these really interesting ethical questions that you talk about. One of the things that stuck out is, you know, that this particular doctor, the patients are there because they want male anatomy removed and not just because of you know, sexual function afterward. But removal itself is the goal. Would you talk a little bit about the sort of the ethical, the emotional, psychological questions that play out in this chapter?
Sure. Yeah. The surgeon, Dr. Garcia, he talked about when a trans woman comes in for bottom surgery, there's an assumption sometimes made by surgeons, like, okay, you want the vulvoplasty for the exterior and the mm-hmm. vaginoplasty. You want the whole package. But, well, the vaginoplasty is the tricky part, and if there's going to be complications, that's where it's going to be. So he presents to them the option, like, if what you're really interested is looking how you feel, looking what feels to you as right and normal, we don't have to do the vaginoplasty. We can just create a vulva for you that's very realistic. And right. and he talked about how, you know, there's this assumption on the part of some male surgeons that, my God, everybody wants to be penetrated. We have to have a vagina. And he's right. like, you know what, for some, they just want to look how they feel. They want to look down and not see a penis. And so for them, there is this option that's simpler and there are fewer complications. Just give people the options. Don't make assumptions. You know, it's like for a long time, women were not often presented with the option to just go flat after a mastectomy. And it was just assumed that, well, we're going to go through a series of plastic surgeries to recreate breasts. And that's where, you know, there are complications. It's not simple. It's not a simple procedure. And so nowadays, since there's been a lot more talk about it, and there was that famous Tig Notaro, that comedian who did her whole or portions of her monologue without her shirt, just say, like, this is an option and this might work for you and it's safer. And, you know, just sort of this assumption of, perhaps is on the part of male surgeons, like, my God, a woman has to have breasts. You know, it's kind of, I remember doing a story on medical anthropology years and years ago and learning that in France, mastectomy was looked upon, and this is a long time ago, I'm old, but it was like, we can't cut off a woman's breasts. That's just, you know, what is a woman without her breasts? You know, that kind of mentality.
There's this really interesting moment in a chapter in the book I want to get into. It's this reveal that's so interesting. And it comes in this story you tell in rural Mongolia. First of all, tell us why you're there. You're following the surgeon who is performing these cataract surgeries, basically. Like, no, they're really basic. No lasers, no robotics. It's very low tech technique. But tell us about this part.
I went there with a nonprofit called Orbis, which tries to restore sight in rural areas, places where there aren't a lot of surgeons and there are not very modern pieces of equipment. So the thinking is, what will give us the greatest good? You know, this procedure is not up to speed. It's not phaco emulsification. It's not the surgery that is done here in the United States in any urban area. It's not that, but it's very good. And if the alternative is blindness, let's try to treat as many people as we can. And the way that they do it is not to go in and set up for a week and do as many people as they can. They train the local surgeons how to do this. So again, it's just the idea of what will create the greatest good? You know, how can we help the largest number of people possible in the best way we can, given what we have to work with? And I thought that was a kind of a noble effort. And also, I always wanted to go to Mongolia.
What? Yeah, good excuse. Yeah. Exactly. I guess the moment, the reveal I wanted you to ask about is the time when the bandages come off. And so they're living with this impaired vision. I mean, you see these videos all the time of people who get, you know, these cochlear implants, and it's just they burst into tears. And of course they would, and they're remarkable. And other people, you know, and I guess you had that kind of expectation.
Yeah.
At this moment as well.
I did. So the people who had been treated were people who, they were nomadic. They were coming in from essentially clusters of, well, they're called gers. There were yurts. People here know that word more than ger. So they're coming in sometimes on horseback. They're kind of, you know, they're coming to this small city or large town and having this procedure whereby they'll now be able to see. They'll be able to see, you know, they're not blind before. Some of them may have had one eye done, but still, just I had a sense of that you would they'd be bursting into tears and saying, "Oh, it's the first time I can see my grandchild," that kind of thing. But they're very, the reactions were very muted, and I was said to the surgeon, "Like, what? Why? I'm more excited than she is. Yeah. What's going on?" And she said, "You know, it's a hard life. These women are, you know, you're getting up the crack of dawn. You're going, you know, out to the river when it's 30 degrees. That's your toilet. You know, you're having to milk all these animals and then quickly make it into cheese so it doesn't go bad. It's a nonstop working day. So that's a hard life." And they're kind of used, they don't complain very much, and they don't like, they're not really like woohoo kind of people. But the most, I think the one man kept looking up at the lights and yeah. He said, obviously he didn't live in a yurt, he said, "It's like HDTV." So that was about the most excitement that was expressed. But I it's just cultural. It's just a, you know, we are used to seeing people on reality TV who have these hyped up, very emotional reactions to everything.
Mary Roach. Her book is called Replaceable You. It just came out in paperback. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Mary Roach. We're talking about her latest book, Replaceable You. You go to this 5K race. It's an ostomy awareness run. And, you know, it's these people have had this ostomy surgery, most of them, you know, after living with, you know, like inflammatory bowel disease. And it's transforms their lives. But then it comes with this, I have to say, kind of surprising sense of stigma that you write about. What did you make of this? To tell us a little bit about this.
I wasn't that surprised that there is that stigma. I mean, the idea of taking away a very basic bodily function and replacing it with, you know, a pouch outside the body feels very foreign to people, particularly somebody who's never dealt with inflammatory bowel disease. If your reality is that you don't feel comfortable straying far from a bathroom, that you have all these symptoms all the time, that you're not making it to the bathroom sometimes, you may put off an ostomy, but frequently, I mean, there were people that I talked to, heard this again and again, "I wish I had done it sooner," because now you're in control again. It's again that attitude that prevails among people who don't have to deal with the realities of having, you know, whether it's a foot that doesn't work or inflammatory bowel disease. And so now here's an improvement. It's not 100% as good as what nature has us start out with, perhaps, but it's so much better than what you were dealing with. So I think, you know, the stigma comes from people like us going like, "Oh God, that must be terrible." You know, when you're in fact, you're like, "No, you want to know what's terrible? The pain and embarrassment of having extreme, you know, Crohn's or colitis and not being able to control your output. That's what's terrible." But that, you know, it's the attitude coming from people who don't know better.
Yeah. It is part of it. I don't want to overthink this, but like that, I don't know. And if you, and I wonder if you saw this in any of the other kinds of stories that you were researching that, because you sort of mentioned this at the top, you know, the idea of the body not being whole, what we make of that.
Sure. I think it's another example of this feeling that the body should be incorruptible, that it should remain whole, that we shouldn't be replacing bits. I mean, they're just this. I mean, obviously, ideally, you want to have the parts that you started out with and to have them keep functioning. But, you know, as you get older, we all end up needing something. I mean, I was talking to one of the Paralympic athletes, kind of thinking of myself as the person who doesn't have any prosthetics. And then I thought, well, I'm legally blind without my contact lenses. That's my prosthetic. You know, who am I to say that I'm an able-bodied person? If I had to try to go through life without glasses or contacts, I'd probably be dead by now.
Since the book came out, you've talked about having to go back and call like these laboratories that you had featured in the book before the book went to print, just to kind of make sure that their funding was still there, or whether the project itself still existed because there was funding. And it's happening against obviously this backdrop of real cuts to federal research funding under the Trump administration. What have you discovered?
Well, the DOGE program was just getting underway when the book was about to go into first proofs. So I still had time to add an epilogue, and so I did, because I wanted to call these folks and the extracorporeal life support, the bioprinting lab at Carnegie Mellon. What they were saying is, like, we are so far okay, but there's a climate of fear and a lack of hope for the future. So, I mean, they're still going, as far as I know. I mean, I haven't checked back recently. Fingers crossed they're okay. But just frustration and anxiety, I guess, across the board and just a sense of, like, not just is this, these are programs that have got long-term grants, multi-year grants, and even those weren't safe. You know, the idea that you could take a program that is, you know, has been funded for years and is all of that work that's happened already, and you could just jettison that, it makes no sense whatsoever. I got a lot of frustration. And there's just also this sense of, you know, we're just, in terms of this country's ability to be competitive, to continue to make innovations and to have the workforce to push those innovations forward. It's devastating. So, I heard a lot of that.
It seems like one of the things that we learn from the book is this kind of the laborious process for finding replacements. There's this kind of long, kind of unglamorous road between discovery and then you get to the actual device that could actually be useful. And I wondered, do you think that the pace of that is changing? Which, of course, gets us to the question of where you think AI is going to fit in all of this, replacing the body.
I was kind of shocked at how long things do take. I mean, to get something to market, to go through preclinical and clinical trials is at least 10 years, $100 million. So it's very slow. So, but there is, I felt like it was slow, but then I would talk to people in this world, like the people in the world of bioprinting, and I remember, and their sense was that things are really going fast. And I said, oh, that's great. Like, when do you feel like there will be a 3D, like a printed organ, bioprinted, like on a printer organ that could be put into a human body and work? How near are we? And he's like, oh, it's going to happen pretty soon. Yeah, like 15 years.
Yeah.
my sense of soon and theirs We're very different. But I think like you mentioned AI, I think AI is speeding up everything in in the biosciences. So, he compared where we're at to, if you looked at flight aviation, he said, we're in the Wright brothers phase right now, which is both like really exciting. Like there's breakthroughs and this is happening. But then again, it's like the long way to cross country airplane travel. So it's both really fast and really slow was my takeaway, but getting faster.
Yeah. You say at the end of the book that you'd come to this point in the research, and you weren't really that far into it when you came to believe that right now there really isn't an artificial replacement that measures up to what the body can do on its own. In fact, here's how you put it in the book. You say, I began to suspect that I now believe that even the simplest part of the human body defies efforts to recreate it. First of all, tell us about this realization. What was the moment?
Well, I had begun to suspect that, like I said, and then I thought, let me see if there's anything on the human body or in the human body that we have come up with a replacement for, something simple. And I thought, okay, tears, that's stuff on the outside of the eyeball. What about that? So I called this guy. His name is escaping me, but I called him up and I said, so tell me about tears. And we were on a Zoom, right? And I'm too cheap to have one, a paid account. So it's 45 minutes. So we were two free Zoom calls, like 45 minutes. It's like an hour and a half. And he's still talking about how unbelievably complex and incredible the tear film is. Not the stuff that you cry, per se, but the layer that protects the eye, that, lubricates it and keeps it safe. There's this whole structure called the glycocalyx, and it's like this scaffold that holds the layers where they're supposed to be. And there's mucins, and there's lubricin, and there's this, this whole world of tear biology. And I said, well, but there's artificial tears that people drop in their eye. How good are those? And he's like, yeah, those are good for a couple of hours, but they kind of just wash away the good stuff. So we don't even have that. You know what the one replacement that is really impressive, and I don't really write, I wrote about it in a different book, is the fecal microbiome transplant. And it works really well. It's a lifesaver. And it, at the time, it was very cheap. That works really well. That's the best I can give you.
Well, you say 50 years from now, you have no doubt that all the promises in the chapters of the book will have been realized, but you're still convinced that none of the replacements we come up with will ever quite be equal to the ones we start out with, I guess it is. So I guess finally, really, you think so? Even with the sort of crazy pace and exponential increase of artificial intelligence, you still feel that way?
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be 100% there. I think we'll be able to create something that does what it needs to do to keep you alive, but it's not going to have the grace and complexity and just mind-blowing awesomeness of what these bits and pieces do on their own. If you've got a body part, whether it's a knee or a kidney, that's not functioning, I think the parts that we create to replace those failing or non-functioning pieces are getting better and better and better, and they're certainly going to enable you to get by and have functionality, as they say. But it's just so much going on in any part of the human body, and you don't need it to be that complex. You're creating a stand-in that needs to just do a couple of functions, or it doesn't have to be as unbelievably streamlined and complicated and awesome. But that streamline and complicated awesome thing, no, I don't think anybody's ever going to make that as a replacement. I don't think it's fair to even expect it to catch up that quickly. It's pretty tough challenge to create something that's as complex and kind of mind-blowingly cool as the human body.
Mary Roach, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary Roach. Her book is Replaceable You, Adventures in Human Anatomy, just came out in paperback. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Aidan Oneida is our social media producer. Our intern is Jill Tuft. The program produced by Tim Slover. I'm Dr. Fabrizio.